All right, let's briefly review the latter part of chapter 21, anyway, through chapter 23. And tonight we've got to cover chapter 24 to chapter 28. Some of it's simple, just narrative, a few comments here and there. I'll point out what I want you to remember. In chapter 21, when Paul comes to the end of his third missionary journey in Jerusalem, the apostles and elders in Jerusalem, James in particular, makes a statement, a proposition to Paul about relieving the minds of thousands of Jews who have heard that he teaches that the Jewish Christians ought not to circumcise their children and ought not to walk according to the customs of the law. And so what they propose for Paul is that he pay charges with the men who have a vow, the four men who have a vow, and go into the temple, of course, and fulfill the vow. And Paul does this in keeping with what I believe to be was actually in accordance with the gospel and his liberty in the gospel. And in no way he was involved in keeping the law of Moses as a system of justification, but rather walking according to the customs of the Jews, which was custom or a custom of their nation. And certainly Paul had never taught that the Jews were not to circumcise their children. Anything that a Jew could do which was not a violation of the gospel of Christ, certainly he was at liberty to do. And so this, I think, is the classification or category into which we must place the things that Paul was engaged in Acts chapter 21. But as he went into the temple and was in the process of bearing the charges of those four men and fulfilling the vow, then Jews from Asia began to stir the people up and to make accusations against Paul. What was the accusation that they had made against Paul? Had he done that? No. They just assumed that he had taken Trophimus, who was evidently a Gentile, into the temple, because they had seen Paul and Trophimus together earlier. So they accused Paul of defiling the temple, and they caused a great stir in the process of beating Paul. And who is it that interferes and stops them from taking his life, Sharon? What's his name? Claude, that's right. Claudius Lysias. And takes Paul captive, takes him away from the crowd, and bears him up evidently to the steps of the garrison, that is, of the fort. And it's here that Paul asks of him that he might give defense unto the Jews. And so Claude gives him liberty, and he begins to speak. And this is chapter 22, the first defense that he makes in the presence of the mob of the Jews. And evidently, as I said, this takes place on the steps of the garrison, the steps of the fort, where Claudius, Lysias, and his soldiers abide. So as he begins to speak, what he does is go back over his conversion that took place in what chapter? Chapter 9, that's right. And so we skip most of the material. I ask you to memorize chapter 22, verse 16, in which we find information that adds somewhat to the account in the 9th chapter of Acts. But anyway, when Paul finishes what he is saying, the Jews respond, away with such a fellow, he's not fit to live. And they begin to tear off their clothes and to throw dust into the air in anger and frustration. And so the chief captain, Claudius, or Claude, put Paul in bonds and was about to beat him. He was about to scourge him, to examine him by scourging him. And Paul told him something that stopped him. He mentioned one word that put a stop to the examination by scourging. What was that? Roman. The word Roman carried a great deal of weight in that period of time. For no Roman could be beaten without being tried. And in fact, it was extremely difficult to beat a Roman even after he was tried. So on the morrow, Claudius decided that he would have the council of the Jews to come and to make their accusations against Paul. And he would listen to them that he might know of what they were accusing. This is chapter 23. Now the first defense is chapter 22. That's where Paul goes over, rehearses the the events of his conversion. And of course, it concludes with the Jews being upset. They haven't listened to a thing he said, really, or been convinced by it. And so, then the 23rd chapter begins with the next day, and Claudius bringing in the Jews, the council, high priest at this time, who is Ananias, and they begin to make their accusations against Paul. Of course, the high priest demands that Paul be smitten. Paul, in turn, calls him a whited wall. And evidently, this man has usurped the right of high priest. He is by no means a moral man, and like many of the Jews and the high priests and the Pharisees of that time, resorted to whatever ends they might use to accomplish, or whatever means they might use to accomplish their end. So when Paul begins his defense to the council in the 23rd chapter of Acts, what does he use as a wedge to divide them and to cause dissension amongst them? All right, the resurrection. He says, I'm called in question because of my belief in the resurrection. I'm a Pharisee. I believe in the resurrection. So the Sadducees, of course, who did not believe in the resurrection, began a dispute with the Pharisees who did believe in the resurrection. And this caused another uproar, and Claude had to step in again and save Paul. They were about to tear him apart. So there are how many men who make a vow?
40
men who make a vow. What's the vow? Alright. They are so determined to take Paul's life that they're not going to eat or drink until they have slain Paul. Who brings this to Paul's attention and then is sent on to Claude with this information? Or his nephew, his sister's son. Then Claudius, in turn, sends Paul to what city? Caesarea. He goes by way of Antipatris, and from there on, let's see, the horsemen are the only ones who continue on, aren't they? From Antipatris, the others are sent back. How many horsemen were there? 70. How many soldiers? How many spearmen? Good. 5%. So Paul comes to Caesarea, in the which, who is going to give him a hearing? Felix. Felix is referred to as, what's his ruling? Governor. That's right. He's referred to as the governor. Now on the board, as we get through chapter 24 and 25 and 26 in particular, before Paul starts his journey on the ship to Rome, I have listed some of these rulers. I might just give that information to you now so that as we go through it, you'll have some idea about it. I don't know how much of this I'll ask you to remember, except it is interesting to see how they are all interrelated. Now, of course, we know that these rulers, in fact, every ruler who ruled in Judea or Palestine or Syria and the nations, regions round about, had their authority as a result of the Caesar, the ruler in Rome itself. So it was by his decree that each of these ruled. Now the difficulty is that from time to time, for instance, when Herod the Great died finally, instead of passing on his territory of rule to one man, it was divided up among about three people, amongst three people. And so then in the process of, say, 20 or 30 years, and you have the territories that are governed, the boundaries of these territories changing. Instead of all one territory being ruled by one man, you have it cut up into about three men. See, there was Philip, and there was Antipatris, and then the son of Herod the Great, who was Herod Agrippa. Now, Herod Agrippa, we find in the 12th chapter of Acts. And what one thing do you remember about Herod Agrippa? In the first part of the 12th chapter, what did he do? Which one?
James.
He killed James with a sword. And then, of course, do you remember where it was he went and they proclaimed a great feast for him and he stood up and made a great oration and they cried out, it's the voice of the gods and not of men?
Caesarea.
That's right. That's the place now where Paul finds himself, in Caesarea. This is the capital. Now why did they go down to Jerusalem? Why do these kings go down to Jerusalem? They usually journey down to Jerusalem during the feast days. Because in the feast days, Jews from all the nations round about have centered. I'm right. You're right. Up to Jerusalem. They journey up to Jerusalem during the feast days because all these Jews are coming in, and his presence helps to hold them in check, to keep down an insurrection. So usually at feast days, you'll find one of these rulers around somewhere in Jerusalem. So Herod Agrippa was in Jerusalem. Beheaded James, went back to Caesarea, and this was where he made his great oration, and they cried that his was the voice of God and not of man. And of course, he was eaten with worms. Now, from Herod Agrippa I, you have his son, Herod Agrippa II. At the time that Herod Agrippa I died, in the 12th chapter, Herod Agrippa II was about 17 years old. Now, at this time, Caesar said that Herod Agrippa II was not old enough to take over his father's territory. And so he made him rule over a little province off some other place, you see. I started with a C, I forgot the name of it. C-L something. But anyway, some years later, this Herod Agrippa II takes over the territory that his father once ruled, and the capital is Caesarea. And it is this Agrippa that we find in the 25th chapter. And at the time that we find him in the 25th chapter, he's about 30 to 31 years old. About, 14 years have elapsed from chapter 12 now to chapter 25. But it's also interesting to note that two people are mentioned together, Agrippa and Bernice. Bernice, or Bernice, was the sister of Agrippa. And it was an open scandal amongst all the Jews. Both of these had a Jewish mother. They were brother and sister, but they lived together. And this was a scandalous thing amongst the Jews. Drusilla is also the daughter of Herod Agrippa I. And whose husband? Whose husband is Drusilla? Felix, that's right. So Felix and Agrippa are brother-in-laws, you see. Now, it all gets mixed up, intermarriage, but you see how it's kind of a family affair, you see. Now, later on, we'll appreciate this more when we get into the 24th and 25th chapters in his trial before Felix and before Festus, and then finally before Agrippa the second. Isn't that interesting? That's really interesting. All right.
Did you say Drusilla and Bernice?
All brothers and sisters. That's right.
That care of family is a complicated study.
It is.
I got the full chart. My big dick man left to carry the full chart that's on the brother and family.
Yeah.
Yeah, about, what, five wives?
Yeah.
Six. Maybe six.
She is a Jewish, but so they're half Jew. Their mother was a Jew. And this is the reason that when Paul stands before Agrippa, he says, Agrippa, believest thou the prophets? I know that thou believest the prophets. You see, Agrippa had a background, and being half Jew himself, was of the Jewish faith. That is, in some parts. Now, he didn't practice it morally, but in belief, he was a Jew, just like Drusilla was. But the thing about Drusilla is that she didn't even belong or shouldn't even be married to Felix.
Well, one of those women, I believe, called him Lady John Baptist. Well, one of those women told him, she had a dream.
Pilate's wife said this about Jesus. Uh-huh. I've forgotten, J.D. Now, Drusilla, at this time, in chapter 24, is about 20 to 22 years old. When Herod Agrippa died in chapter 12, she was 6. She was just a little girl. But at a very early age, she married another king, and his name started with an E, but I've forgotten what his name was, but that's not important. The important thing is that after she was married to him for a while, Felix, through a sorcerer who was called Simon, caused her to, enticed her to leave her husband and to come and live with him. So really, this was an unlawful marriage here, you see, amongst Drusilla and Felix. And here you have Drusilla and Felix, who shouldn't be married to each other or who should be living together. Then you have Agrippa living with his sister. It's a mess. These Herods were very immoral people. And most of them, and this is the reason that when Paul began to reason with Felix about righteousness, temperance, and judgment to come, but Felix trembles because he knows that what Paul is saying is true. And they were all very immoral, very few of them very moral men at all. And this is exemplified in their response to Paul and to his needs, and their use of Paul, or attempt to use Paul to accomplish what's best for themselves. All right. Beginning in chapter 24, and after 5 days, Ananias the high priest descended with the elders with a certain orator named Tertullus, who informed the governor against Paul. Now, evidently, this Tertullus is something like a lawyer today. He was a Roman lawyer. He wasn't a Jew. But they had stated their case to Tertullus, and now Tertullus was to appear in the court before Felix and was to state their case. And when he was called forth, Tertullus began to accuse him, saying, "Seeing that by thee we enjoy great quietness, and that very worthy deeds are done of this nation by thy providence, we accepted always and in all places most noble Felix with all thankfulness." That's the way you begin every speech when you're going to butter somebody up. So Tertullus indeed was an orator, and he was a man well equipped in knowledge and tact to appear before Felix. And he began his case. Some of this might have been true because Felix was noted for the fact that he had ridded the country of some of the men who were leading insurrections and so forth and quieted some of these things. But it's very likely that he might have exaggerated this to some degree. So in verse 4 he says, "Notwithstanding, thou be not further tedious. I'm tedious unto thee. I pray thee that thou wouldest hear us of thy clemency a few words." That is, that you'll have forbearance with us in what we have to say. "For we have found this man a pestilent fellow. He's a pest. He's a mover of insurrections. He's always causing trouble. A mover of sedition among all the Jews throughout the world, and a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes, who also hath gone about to profane the temple, whom we took and would have judged according to our law." Now let's pause there for just a moment. These are the accusations that are being made against Paul. Now this statement here that's made by Tertullus is not the same as that which was made before Claudius. You see, they accused Paul before Claudius of defiling the temple. Now, they changed it. They're accusing Paul simply of being a troublemaker throughout the world, a mover of seditions, a man who's always creating trouble, a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes, and listen now how they change the charge, "who also hath gone about to profane the temple." Now, they don't say that he did it, but that this perhaps was his intent to do. We caught him before he did it, you see, but this is what he was going to do. "And we took him and would have judged him according to our law, but the chief captain Lysias came upon us and with great violence took him away out of our hands." Well, that was the only way that's the only way Claude could have gotten Paul out, wasn't it? They were in the process of beating him. They weren't judging him. And so, like many other things, who was it that wrote the letter and kind of exaggerated the truth somewhat? Claudius did. And now, Tertullus is slanting the facts just a little bit, to say the least. And we were going to judge him, you see. We were conducting ourselves uprightly. We're going to take Paul and judge him according to our law. But in comes old, mean, black-headed Claude, and he takes, by force, Paul out of our presence, you see, and he won't let us judge Paul. "Commanding his accusers to come unto thee." All right, now this is what Claudius has proposed. "By examining of whom thyself mayest take knowledge of all these things whereof we accuse him." And the Jews also assented, saying that these things were so. All right, here the Jews standing about. Tertullus has stated the case. And the Jews say, "Yes, that's right. Amen. That's right, Tertullus. You did a fine job of preaching." Now back up to the accusation that he was a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes. Why would they accuse Paul of that? Sect of the Nazarenes. Who in the world would that be? Right. So what they're doing is reducing Jesus simply to a man, you see. A man about whom there were many followers. And these followers became known as the Nazarenes because he was a man of Nazareth. They, of course, denied his deity. They denied that he was the Messiah. And so this is the accusation that's made against Paul, a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarene.
That's really an allusion to members of the church.
Yeah, that's right. They were described this way strictly from the point of view of saying they're
term not.
That's right. Followers of this man of Nazareth. It was used in derision, of course. Then Paul, after that the governor had beckoned to him to speak, answered, "For as much as I know that thou hast been of many years a judge unto this nation, I do the more cheerfully answer for myself. Because that thou mayest understand that there are yet but 12 days since I went up to Jerusalem for to worship." Now, why would he mention the time?
12 days he could have done 30.
No, sir. No way in the world he could have caused all these things and being a pestilent fellow and a mover of seditions in 12 days. You just can't do that. It takes a while, you see, to cause all this disturbance. And then in verse 12, he answers the second part of her charge. "And they neither found me in the temple disputing with any man, neither raising up the people, neither in the synagogues nor in the city." And what about his intent to defile the temple, profane the temple? Not so. Paul says they didn't find me there in amongst people. They didn't see me in the city stirring people up. They can't prove, neither can they prove things whereof they now accuse me. "But this I confess unto thee, that after the way which they call heresy, so worship I the God of my fathers, believing all the things which are written in the law and in the prophets, and have hope toward God, which they themselves also allow, that there should be a resurrection of the dead, both of the just and of the unjust." It says, "I plead guilty to this charge, not of what they've accused me." Now, they've accused me of being a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes. "But in answer to this charge, that I confess that I am a worshiper of God, and I'm a worshiper of God, believing the things that were written in the prophets, just like they believed in, and what's more, believing in the resurrection, just like they believe in the resurrection." Then in verse 15, "and have hope toward God, which they themselves also allow, that there," or that we've already read that verse. Verse 16, "and herein do I exercise myself to have always a conscience void of offense toward God and toward men. Now after many years I came to bring alms to my nation and offerings." What does that refer to, the alms and offerings? That's right, from the churches of Macedonia and Achaia for the poor saints in Jerusalem. Romans 15:25, he writes to the church in Rome about it. "Whereunto, or whereupon certain Jews from Asia found me purified in the temple, neither with a multitude nor with a tumult." Now, what you find here, Paul says, when I was in the temple, it wasn't an uprising. It wasn't a disturbance of any kind. I was there, and there was peace and quiet. "Who ought to have been here before thee and object if they had aught against me." Now, Paul says, if these men want to accuse me of something, who found me in the temple, they need to be here. Not Tertullius, not the high priest, but they are the accusers. Then they need to be there. Yes, Calvin.
That's a very strong point, because I've seen in the courtroom where, for instance, there was a lawyer said, where is the man here that's representing the company? What do they care about this man over here that's suing them about his welfare? Don't backfire on him, because he said, here's the man that's involved, the man that's in the accident. You're actually suing and calling the whole thing. And where is your man? The first day he left, so the whole thing fell flat on him. Instead of this hard mouthpiece that they had there, where are your accusers? So that makes a good point.
They should have been there.
They
should have been there. All right. "Except it be for this one voice that I cried standing among them, touching the resurrection of the dead, I am called in question by you this day." Now, where does Paul put all the emphasis in his defense? In the resurrection. Time and time again. Now, you remember that point. Time and time again, when Paul stands up to defend himself of what he's called in question about, "I'm called in question about the resurrection of the dead." Now, specifically, of course, he had reference to Jesus Christ being raised from the dead. But it was that the belief, of course, in the resurrection of all men is dependent upon the resurrection of Christ.
We can make our stand right there, too. When Jesus performed many miracles, he came into the world by a miracle, virgin birth. We don't have to argue the virgin birth. We don't have to argue whether he walked on the water or turned the water into wine or turned or fed the 5,000 with loaves and fish. If we can make it stand on the resurrection from the dead, our case is won. That's the only one we have to really argue, and that's the best one that can be proved, and that's where his divinity all hinges.
Mm-hmm.
Now, regardless of how he was born, the fact that God raised him from the dead, that declared him to be the Son of God with power.
The man will accept that, of course, he'll accept all the other two.
He has to say.
Well, the angel said in a meeting there, that's the only miracle he would affirm the resurrection. Because he said, if I could prove that, I would do it.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only one he would affirm. That's the easiest, one of the easiest things.
Mm-hmm. I guess it would be the most powerful.
On the other hand, like we argue in the Bible, if it is no resurrection, everything else is barred.
Might as well forget about it. Go on your own way and live like you want to live.
Really important.
Mm-hmm.
That's what Paul was arguing about, the baptism from the dead. And they made a doctrine about it, but he wasn't even talking about baptism. He was talking about the resurrection.
Yeah, the resurrection is the point in 1 Corinthians 15. All right, and when Felix heard these things, having more perfect knowledge of that way, how do you think he'd know anything about that way? Well, he might know from two points of view. Drusilla, of course, being his wife, being a Jewish, would have informed him about the Jewish religion. And of course, being in that country and being acquainted with the fact that there were religious movements, you see, he'd be aware of what was going on, and he had heard of this Jesus. So he had perfect knowledge of that way. He deferred them and said, when Lysias the chief captain shall come down, I will know the uttermost of your matter. Now, poor old Claudius Lysias, I think he was completely ignorant of the whole controversy and the reason for the controversy. I don't know whether he ever understood what the whole issue was about or not, you see. He was simply a ruler of 1,000 men. Teliarch. Is that right?
Teliarch,
that's right. Let me back up and see.
C-H-I-L-I.
Kiliarch. That's right.
Your footnote there of
That's back in the 21st chapter, and then 27th.
It mentioned in the 23rd chapter, too.
For instance, in chapter 21, verse 33, and the chief captain came near, it says the Kiliarch is pronounced, the Greek pronunciation, the CH is a guttural sound, Kiliarch.
Where I get that sound at.
Where did you say that?
Chapter 21:33. The chief captain, that word is a Kiliarch.
Oh, I thought you
No, it's the chief captain of King James Version.
They use a lot of Greek in chemistry. And we have a word chelate, the CH, and it has that T sound.
Yeah.
Like it's spelled K-E-Y.
Yeah.
And it's the same word, same prefix as we have here.
Over 1,000.
Yeah. I believe that's a root of 1,000. Yeah. 1,000 meters. Kilometer? Yeah. All right. Now, we're down to verse 23. And he commanded the centurion to keep Paul, to let him have liberty, that he should forbid none of his acquaintances to minister or come unto him. So, Felix gives him quite a bit of liberty. And after certain days, when Felix came with his wife Drusilla, which was a Jewish, like I said, she was a Jewish as a result of being born of a Jewish mother, a Jewish woman. Now Herod Agrippa was not a Jew, but he was a Roman, and his wife was a Jewish. So Drusilla is called a Jewish. He sent for Paul and heard him concerning the faith in Christ. Now verse 25, you will need to remember. Oh, I have written down here, I put a footnote, that the man, the husband to whom Drusilla actually belonged was a man by the name of Azias, A-Z-I-Z, if you want to remember that.
And that's the one that that's the one that sorcerer persuaded
that's right.
her to leave.
The sorcerer, I believe his name was Simon, persuaded her to leave Azias and to come to.
You'll see the sales Mary in a story about that. Well,
yeah.
He tells us that that's those bad things.
So you'll need to know verse 25, and as he reasoned of righteousness, temperance, and judgment to come, Felix trembled. Those three things are very important. Can you understand why Paul might have used those three points? Now, we don't know what he said, but righteousness. Now, what would Felix know about righteousness? Little or nothing. Of temperance, self-control. Why, the very act that he did in enticing another man's wife away from him would indicate the fact that he didn't exercise any self-control. Whatever his appetites wanted, this is what he got, you see. And it says, Josephus says of Drusilla that she was a very beautiful woman. So he set his eye upon her. He decided he was going to have her. He exercised no self-control, no restraint whatsoever. So there's one particular instance in which he needed this point. And of judgment to come. Do you think these rulers like Felix were very concerned about the judgment to come? To them, you see, to them they exercised authority and right of judgment in their courts. But they didn't exercise it based on what was right and wrong. They exercised their judgment based upon what was best for them. That's right. And this was the outcome of most all of the decisions, what was best for them. So it says that Felix trembled. He was afraid. And answered, go thy way this time. When I have a convenient season, I will call for thee. He hoped also that money should have been given him of Paul, that he might loose him. Wherefore he sent for him the oftener and communed with him. Now that indicates again the fact that all he was really interested in was money and what could be best for himself without any friend. Yes, Calvin.
That's a convenient season. A lot of times we miss both things.
More convenient.
It doesn't say much.
No, that's right. Then in verse 27, the close of chapter 24, and after 2 years, Porcius Festus came into Felix's room. Do you know what that expression means? Does anyone else have another translation?
He succeeded.
Yeah, he succeeded him. Now, you wouldn't get that impression from reading the King James Version. He came into his room, all right, he came for a visit, but that's not what it's saying. That he was succeeded by Felix. And Felix, willing to show the Jews a pleasure, left Paul, he was succeeded by Porcius Festus, Felix was. And Felix, willing to show the Jews a pleasure, left Paul bound. So right at the very end, you see the character of Felix depicted, displayed time and time again. Do you have a question?
Does that mean that he was a prisoner 2 years?
Yes. At least 2 years. A little bit longer than 2 years, really. Now, when Festus was come into the province, after 3 days, he ascended from Caesarea to Jerusalem, went up to Jerusalem. Then the high priest and the chief of the Jews informed him against Paul and besought him. Wouldn't you think that men would forget about something after 2 years?
2 years.
No, sir. Memory of an elephant. So they desired favor against him that he would send for him to Jerusalem, laying in wait in the way to kill him. Now they
What town was this in?
Caesarea. This is down in Jerusalem now.
And part of he was in prison.
Caesarea.
Still in
Caesarea. Now Festus has succeeded Felix. He goes up to Jerusalem. While he's in Jerusalem, and the Jews, the high priest, they come to Festus, and we want Paul. We want you to bring Paul down here. We're going to try him, you see. We're going to give him a good try. What they had in mind, you see, when they brought him down here, we're going to lay him wait along the way, and we're going to kill him. That's
getting
what
awful hungry by them, aren't you?
I imagine they'd forsaken their vow by that time. they'd had to break their vow.
They starved to death.
No. different bunch altogether if they kept their vow. And Festus answered that Paul should be kept at Caesarea and that he himself would depart shortly thither. Now, I'm sure that Festus understood it would create quite a bit of problem. After all, he didn't know anything about Paul, really, except perhaps as Felix had left him in chains or left him bound, but he had never heard from Paul or heard anything about Paul, and Paul was just there in prison because Felix wanted to leave him there. He left him in Festus' hand. But he said that he was going back up to Caesarea. He says, now, let them therefore which among you are able, go down with me and accuse this man if there be any wickedness in him. You come on down to Caesarea, and we'll talk about it there. We'll have a trial there. And when he tarried among them more than 10 days, he went down to Caesarea. The next day, sitting on the judgment seat, commanded Paul to be brought. And when he was come, the Jews which came down from Jerusalem stood round about and laid many and grievous complaints against Paul, which they could not prove. Now, time and time again, they try to make something, some kind of a case. Of course, Luke is recording this, and he's recording it, looking at it, I think, from the point of view of Festus, that they couldn't prove what they were saying. Many grievous complaints against Paul, but they couldn't prove them. While he answered for himself, neither against the law of the Jews, neither against the temple, nor yet against Caesar, have I offended anything at all. Now that's Paul's defense, which is what he said before, and put it in a shortened form. I have not offended the law of Jews, I have not profaned or defiled the temple, and I've done nothing against Caesar. There is nothing that they have accused me of that's true. But Festus, willing to do the Jews a pleasure, who does that remind you of? Felix. Felix back in the previous chapter 4.
Same
brand. Then said Paul, verse 9. Continuing, it says, wilt thou go up to Jerusalem and there be judged of these things before me? Now, why in the world would he make a suggestion like that? Here was a judgment seat, not in Jerusalem. He was the man who was supposed to be trying it. Why go to Jerusalem before him? Well, the reason was he wanted to show the Jews a pleasure. Wasn't concerned about what was right and wrong. He knew the Jews couldn't prove what they were saying about Paul. So Paul, in verse 10, said, I stand at Caesar's judgment seat, where I ought to be judged. To the Jews have I done no wrong, as thou very well knowest. And why do you want me to go and be judged by the Jews? You know I haven't wronged. So I think Festus understood that. So now Paul, in evading going to Jerusalem, because I'm sure he knows that there are still Jews down there who are interested in taking his life even after 2 years, he appeals his case to Caesar. In verse 11 he says, for if I be an offender or have committed anything unworthy of death, I refuse not to die. I'm ready to die if I'm a criminal and I've done something worthy of death. But if there be none of these things whereof these accuse me, no man can deliver me unto them, I appeal unto Caesar. I'll take my case to the highest court. There's where it ought to be tried, if we're going to continue with this thing. Then Festus, when he had conferred with the council, answered, hast thou appealed unto Caesar? Unto Caesar shalt thou go. All right, you get what you want. You want to go see Caesar? We'll go see Caesar.
That passage proves, man, Paul recognized being an idiot, an inspired man, recognized the power of government to put a man to death.
I think so.
Thus confirms, I think, death penalty.
I think so. If Paul was a prisoner and done something worthy of death, he recognized that the government had the right to put a man to death. So,
no human being can overthrow that argument.
I don't think so. Along with Romans chapter 13. Alright? Then in verse 13, what's the matter, Charlotte?
I'm just asking.
Oh, I just said, okay.
We have to have someone in here who don't believe in capital punishment. Might want to.
Well, I think that's interesting. You know, I'm glad.
You had never thought about that?
No.
Paul refuses not to die if he's done something worthy of death, and thus recognizes the power of government, the civil government, to put a man to death for certain reasons. I think all of that is all right.
I believe so.
God is the one that instituted capital punishment. So man has gotten away from God in every other way, so that's not unusual that he would get away from that too.
Of course, his argument in Romans 13 is that the powers that be do not bear the sword in vain. He recognizes, he says, every power that is of God. It's ordained of God. But he beareth not the sword in vain. Now, the reason for their existence, that if a man does good, he has no fear. But if he does evil, then he ought to be afraid of government, because it's God ordained, regardless of what government it is. And that this government, as ordained by God, has the right to exercise the use of the sword, you see, in taking life. All right, we could get sidetracked, but let's go on. We'll let that be sufficient. Then in verse 13, after certain days, King Agrippa and Bernice, now who were these people? Husband and wife?
Brothers and
brother and sister. Agrippa and Bernice came unto Caesarea to salute Festus. Now there's a little brother-in-law going on. Not actually, they weren't brothers-in-law, but they were both of them rulers, and so they were paying visits to each other. And when they had been there many days, Festus declared Paul's cause unto the king. Now, Festus was only a governor, whereas Herod Agrippa II was a king. So Agrippa was actually over Festus. And this is the reason that you're going to find that now they're going to set in the judgment hall, and Paul is going to appeal his case to the king, who is Herod Agrippa II. He speaks about Paul. There's a certain man left in bonds by Felix, about whom, when I was at Jerusalem, the chief priests and the elders of the Jews informed me, desiring to have judgment against him. Now, he knew that the Jews wanted a judgment against him. They weren't interested in trying him. They wanted a judgment against him. To whom I answered, it is not the manner of the Romans to deliver any man to die, before that he which is accused have the accusers face to face, and have license to answer for himself concerning the crime laid against him. Therefore, when they were come hither, without any delay on the morrow, I sat on the judgment seat and commanded the man to be brought forth, against whom, when the accusers stood up, they brought none accusations of such things as I supposed. Now, you see, they evidently put a pretty good case up to Festus while he was down up in Jerusalem. And Festus thought, well, there must be something to this. He said, all right, now we'll bring Paul out. But when they began to lay their case out against Paul, then I think Festus was really marveling at this. He was amazed at it because it wasn't anything like what he thought he was. It was something entirely different. He says, and he summarizes in verse 19, but have certain questions against him of their own superstition. Now, that actually is the word religion, dealing with their own religion, very much like what you find in the 17th chapter. I perceive that in all things that you are too superstitious, Paul said of the Athenians. Against him of their own superstition, of their own religion, and of one Jesus which was dead, whom Paul affirmed to be alive. Now that's the matter of controversy. What did Paul say I'm called in question for? Belief in the resurrection. Now, Festus says the whole thing deals and centers around the fact of their religion and the fact that Paul believes a dead man is alive. This man, Jesus, who is dead, Paul believes him to be alive. That's the center of the whole controversy. So I think Festus had grasped that much of the accusations made against him, the reason for the accusation. And because I doubted of such manner questions, I asked him whether he would go to Jerusalem and there be judged of these matters. But when Paul had appealed to be reserved unto the hearing of Augustus, who is Augustus?
Emperor.
Caesar. That's right. He's a Caesar this time. Caesar is a word that's used in application to many of the Roman rulers from Rome. But this particular ruler is Augustus. Caesar Augustus.
Before was this king Agrippa?
I don't know where he resided at this time. The governor was residing in Caesarea, which was the head of the capital of that province. And evidently, Agrippa's territory covered more of this, and he must have been residing in another town somewhere.
He was still way less Caesar.
Oh, yes, yes. He was just ruler of a small part of the country.
It
doesn't show all of this here. Caesar
was over all of it.
Yes, he was over the whole thing. Yeah, back in the days of Christ, shortly after the church was established, in about AD 36, these men were called tetrarchs. And they were rulers of certain territories. Remember I mentioned the fact that Herod the Great had divided his territory among three of his sons, and these were called tetrarchs. And then, of course, when they passed from the scene, then these territories, the boundaries were changed up, and different territories and boundaries existed, ruled by different people. But if you have a map of the whole Mediterranean, the extent of Rome's influence down in Africa, you see, crossing Egypt, and on across in Palestine, into Arabia, back up into what was Babylon and the Assyrian Empire, you see, on across into Asia, then across in the provinces you see is Macedonia and Achaia, and then Rome, and even as far as Spain and Great Britain. Their influence, their power was exerted over all of that. And one man ruled that primarily. And this was Caesar. So he had a lot of different rulers underneath him. All right. Let's see. Verse 22, I believe it is. Then Agrippa said unto Festus, I would also hear the man myself tomorrow, said he, thou shalt hear him. And on the morrow, when Agrippa was come and burnished with great pomp. What do you think that pomp is? A lot of ceremony, you know, and show, and all the elaborate dress, and
probably wore all of her jewels.
I imagine she did. Weighted down with all of her jewels. And was entered into the place of hearing with the chief captains and principal men of the city. At Festus' commandment, Paul was brought forth. And Festus said, King Agrippa, and all men which are here present with us, ye see this man, about whom all the multitude of the Jews have dealt with me, both at Jerusalem and also here, crying that he ought not to live any longer. Where do you remember that they cried there? Where is that? 22nd chapter. In his defense at the garrison, when he's first, after he's been beaten, and he stands and makes his defense, and they, after they listen to him, they say, away with him. He's not fit to live.
22,
chapter 22, verse. It's a good way to remember. Alright, let's see. Then, verse 25, but when I found that he had committed nothing worthy of death, that he himself hath appealed to Augustus, I have determined to send him, of whom I have no certain thing to write unto my Lord, wherefore I have brought him forth before you, and especially before thee, O King Agrippa, that after examination had, I might have something, somewhat to write. Why didn't he have anything to write?
No charges.
There were no charges. Here's a man. Accusations have been made against him, but they can't prove these accusations. Now I've got to send him to Augustus. What am I going to say? He's in a dilemma, you see. He's got quite a problem. Nothing I can say. All right, so now we're going to examine before you, O Agrippa, that when we finish with all of this, then maybe I have something to write. Maybe I've got something that I can tell. Wouldn't it be rather embarrassing to send a prisoner all the way from Caesarea to Rome, and he stands up before Caesar, and Caesar says, of what are you charged? Of what are you accused? Nothing. Well, why are you here?
Wasn't they released?
Well, after he had appealed his case, then he had to go through with all this, you see. Very much like sometime today, when certain charges are laid against a person, then these cannot be withdrawn. Legally, it must be carried to the end, and the person either condemned or justified. His name either shown to be what it is, and the charge is true, or his name cleared of all charges.
Well, a lot of times today, in the court, charges are dropped.
That's right, they can be.
We had insufficient evidence here. The old judge would just drop the charges.
The only thing I know is, like he says here, he's appealed his case to Caesar. Therefore, there's nothing that we can do about it. It's out of our hands, you see. He's got
a point of law that's Roman law appealed to Caesar, but you had to go there.
Had to be carried out. Must be.
If they didn't do that, every one of these little bumps down the line would be a important justice. This way, well, Caesar got passed rather than somebody else.
That was the reason he appealed in the first place, you see. Now, Felix or Festus says, well, would you be willing to go back down to Jerusalem? Paul knows what's awaiting there. So he says, no, I appeal my case to Caesar. That's where I'll... There. Yes, sir.
They have remarkable freedom.
Yes, I think so. Roman citizens had a lot of freedom. A lot of liberties.
He was, at first, unconsciously, but later on, consciously, carrying out what the Lord told him.
Mm-hmm.
On the road to Damascus, bearing his name before the king. I think he gets just what the mountain is now.
And later on in the 27th chapter, right before their shipwreck, when the angel appears to Paul in the night and tells him that no life is going to be lost because it's needful for him to go on and to appear before Caesar. So this You see it hinted at time and time again, the reason all this is taking place in God's providence is being worked out. That these kings could hear the gospel being preached. Not only the low, insignificant man of the street, not only the idolater like you find in Athens, but the kings, the rulers, and Caesar himself and all the household of Caesar hear the gospel being preached. That's about the only way it could have been accomplished. No way Paul could just march right into Caesar and preach to him. Or reach his household with all the servants away. So in verse 27 he says, "For it seemeth to me unreasonable to send a prisoner, and not withal to signify the crime laid against him." Well, that's pretty good thinking. Yeah. All right, let's stop here and we'll get a drink of water and come back. All right, beginning in verse 1 of the 26th chapter, we have the introduction of Agrippa. As Paul is being tried before him, as I said, he's the grandson of Herod the Great, who lived in the days of Christ. He was instrumental in trying to take the lives of all, or did take the lives of many of the babies that were born at that time, trying to kill Christ. And the son of the Agrippa of the 12th chapter. Then Agrippa said unto Paul, "Thou art permitted to speak for thyself." Then Paul stretched forth the hand and answered for himself, "I think myself happy, King Agrippa, because I shall answer for myself this day before thee, touching all the things whereof I am accused of the Jews." All right, now he's going to answer again. Is this answer going to be anything different? Same thing. Different point of view, maybe different slant, but basically the same thing. "Especially because I know thee to be an expert in all customs and questions which are among the Jews, wherefore I beseech thee to hear me patiently." Now, I'm not going to go through all of this because it is an enumeration, again, of all the events of his life. Born, raised, strict as a Pharisee, but circle or underline verse 6. He says, "Now I stand and am judged for the hope of the promise made of God unto our fathers, under which promise our 12 tribe instantly serving God day and night hope to come, for which hope's sake, King Agrippa, I am accused of the Jews." Now before he says, "I'm called in question because of the resurrection," he's talking about the same thing, only from a different point of view. What is the hope of the fathers, the hope of Israel? The Messiah come. Now, I'm called in question because I believe in this Messiah, because I have this hope that was of our fathers, the promise that our 12 tribes believe and expect. And he, in the other passages or in other defenses, has stated specifically that he dealt with the resurrection of Jesus Christ, the resurrection of the dead. Now in verse 8 he says, "Why should it be thought a thing incredible with you that God should raise the dead?" And you see, there is where he gets back to his point of the resurrection. "I verily thought with myself that I ought to do many things contrary to the name of Jesus of Nazareth, which thing I also did in Jerusalem." Now he goes back and his point is that many times in many places I persecuted the way. I persecuted Jesus Christ and his disciples. Then he talks about the vision that he saw, the voice that spoke from heaven. Now what is this proving? It's proving the fact that Jesus, who is the hope of Israel, was raised from the dead. And that I, Paul, am a witness of that resurrection. The voice said, "I am Jesus whom thou persecutest." So now Paul is enumerating all of these events, going back all these events, to prove and to connect two things. The hope of Israel, which is the Messiah, with the resurrection of the dead, and himself as being a witness of that resurrection. Now he goes on, he says in verse 19, "Whereof, O King Agrippa, I was not disobedient unto that heavenly vision." Now the vision had said, Jesus had said, "Go into Damascus, and there it will be told you what you must do." So he says that I went into Damascus, and on in Jerusalem, and throughout the coast of Judea, and then to the Gentiles, and showing them that they should repent and turn to God and do works meet for repentance. Now he says, for these causes the Jews caught me in the temple. Not because, as they had accused him, you see, that he was defying the temple. That's not the reason. But because I was preaching this Jesus everywhere. Damascus, Jerusalem, Judea, to all the Gentiles throughout the world. That's the reason that they caught me. And that's the reason they went about to kill me. Having therefore obtained help of God, I continue unto this day, witnessing both the small and great, saying none other things than those which the prophets and Moses did say should come. Now here he's going back, he says in the beginning of his defense to Agrippa, that the thing that I am called in question about in my defense, the reason I was accused of the Jews, is because of the hope of Israel. Now the things that I'm talking about here, and the things I believe, the things I proclaim, are those things which the prophets and Moses talked about. Now underline verse 23. And notice how this connects with verse 22 and back up to the verse that I mentioned in verse 6. Connect those all together. Which the prophets and Moses did say should come, that Christ should suffer, and that he should be the first that should rise from the dead, and should show light unto the people and to the Gentiles. Now that is the hope of our fathers. That's the hope of Israel. The promise God made that Christ should suffer and die and be the first to rise from the dead. You see how all that connects up where Paul has gone? Now, I'll cover this briefly because some of it is simply going back over some events that we learned in chapter 9 that Paul mentioned again in chapter 22. So it's nothing new to us, that part of his defense. But here, the slant is different because the emphasis here is that what I believe is the hope of my fathers. What all Jews are supposed to believe, that the Messiah would come, that the Messiah would be raised from the dead. And that's the hope of Israel. That's the promise that the prophets talked about. And as he thus spake for himself, Festus said with a loud voice, Paul, thou art beside thyself. Much learning doth make thee man. Does Festus understand what Paul's talking about? No. Do you think Agrippa does? Agrippa understands. Agrippa's a Jew. All right, verse 25. But he said, I am not mad, most noble Festus, but speak forth the words of truth and soberness. For the king knoweth of these things, before whom also I speak freely. For I am persuaded that none of these things are hidden from him, for the thing was not done, or this thing was not done in a corner. What do you think he means by that? It wasn't done in a corner.
Openly.
He was openly. It's been published throughout the world. It's not a secret. When you do something in a corner, what do? Try to hide it. That's right. Try to keep it from somebody's view. But not so. King Agrippa, believest thou the prophets? I know that thou believest. Then Agrippa said unto Paul, almost thou persuadest me to be a Christian. That is, putting it in another way, with but little persuasion thou wouldst make me a Christian. And Paul said, I would to God that not only thou, but also all that hear me this day, were both almost and altogether such as I am, except these bonds. Now, can you imagine? I don't know whether I could ever be like Paul in this respect. Here he's called upon to defend himself. Here are the judges, the men sitting about, all the men with their pomp and their glory and in king's array. And Paul's supposed to be defending himself against his charges. But what does he do? He begins to preach to them. He begins to try to reach them. He loses himself and any selfish interest in the hope of trying to teach them and convert them. So I think that if we could have that attitude at all times, it would help us tremendously in our lives as Christians and in teaching others. Sometimes when we might be questioned about something, we might get defensive. You see, we get on the defensive. Paul wasn't ever on the defensive. Paul was always on the offensive. He was always trying to teach people. He was always trying to convert people, even a king. That's what he's doing here.
Well, you know, even in football, they say the best defense is good offense. And that's just what Paul did. He defended himself by being.
That's right. By being aggressive.
That's right.
And, of course, the reason that he was this was because he was not so much interested in his own welfare as he was the welfare of other people. Because he was deeply concerned about the souls of these men.
Sharon, I have a little question here. Verse 23, though, where it said Christ, you know, was the first.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, it was other raised from the dead, but doesn't that mean that first to do this in his own power, through the power of God, without someone
I think the significance is that he was the first to be raised never to die again. Of course, the others who were raised would naturally die again and go back to the grave. But the first one to be raised, which never again would taste of death. And so this...
Acts 2, when nobody had been raised from dead, they were saved besides
Christ. That's right. By the power of God, he was raised from the dead.
Enoch and Elijah didn't die.
That's right.
They went
raised to the... Alright, then in verse 30, and when he had thus spoken, the king rose up, and the governor, and Bernice, and they that sat with him. And when they were gone aside, they talked between themselves, saying, This man doeth nothing worthy of death or of bonds. Then said Agrippa unto Festus, This man might have been set at liberty if he had not appealed unto Caesar. So you see, that shows that actually the appeal was irrevocable. There was no way that it could be changed once that appeal had been made.
It's implied here.
Yeah. All right. Now, chapter 27 and 28 is going to take you through the journey of Paul from Caesarea over across to Rome eventually. Now, like I said, I'm not going to ask you to memorize this third or this last journey, the fourth journey, which is not a missionary journey of preaching, but rather the journey from Caesarea on across to Rome. Now, Luke covers this in what we have two chapters here. What are the, how many verses in chapter 27? 44, and then 31 isn't in chapter 28. That's right. So 75 verses about. He takes to cover this last trip. Now, it's a beautiful narrative. It's quite accurate in all the events. It shows you something about sailing, the difficulties of sailing and under winds that are adverse. So I'm not going to take the time to read all of this, except to point out some things about it. First of all, who was it that was accompanying Paul on the journey? There were at least two men who were going with Paul.
Aristarchus,
where do you read about him? He was one of the men who accompanied the gift, you remember, in the 20th chapter? When Paul departed from Greece, from Philippi, there were men who were selected. You remember that, didn't you, Jesse Lee? You didn't remember that?
Was the blood with Paul here?
Why do you think so? Why do you think so?
We.
Verse 2 says we. That's right. Verse 2 says we. Where's Luke been all this time? Nobody knows. He was with Paul in Jerusalem. And he could.
Verse 1, 2, and 3 says we.
Yeah.
Verse 6 says us.
So it's a pronoun that is inclusive of Luke and Paul, to say the least. And also from the text, Aristarchus of Macedonia, Thessalonica. Alright, now as they sail, like I said, I'm not going to ask you to remember all these places, except generally this is on your map, you'll see that from Caesarea they come across to Sidon. Then coming up here, they come near the coast here of Pamphylia and Cilicia, and come on across here to Myra and Tyra. And up here, they stop at the seaport. And then they change ships. Isn't it here that they change ships? Myra. Yes. Right over here. And it came to Myra, city of Lycia. And there, the centurion found the ship of Alexandria sailing into Italy. Now, where is Alexandria? Well, it's right down here, you see. Right there, down in Egypt.
Yep. From
that's right. And evidently, it was carrying grain. Now, at this time, of course, these ships would be heavy laden with wheat and grain, and they would they'd make certain ports up here, and then all the way across up into Rome. Now, the centurion, of course, had the right to enlist the ship and the owner of the ship in his master's service. If he was performing the duty of Caesar, and this would be a duty of Caesar, taking this man to appeal his case before Caesar, then he could enlist and take charge of this ship on his journey. So this centurion evidently does. What's the name of the centurion?
Julius.
How are you going to remember him?
Julius Caesar.
you can. You might get mixed up with Augustus. Which one, you know, received at this time? Was it Julius or Augustus? So they come across from here. They sail on down. They come on the south side of Crete. And all along the way, the winds are not really the best. Of course, they come under the lee of Crete. And they stop here at Fair Haven. Now, this is where Paul wants them to stay. Well, they've already been there. They crossed up here on this side of Cyprus. That's earlier on up. We've already passed that. You see, we've changed ships over here at Myra. And come on down to Crete, at Fair Havens in Crete, underneath the island. Now, why didn't they winter here in Fair Havens? Well, evidently the ship was in a hurry, and it wasn't conducive to wintering there. Now, Paul wants them to. He tells them that they need to, and if they don't, he says they're going to be lost of goods and loss of life. Now, I don't think he's speaking by the Spirit when he says this, because later on, when they come over here near the island of Malta, or Medea, then the angel appears to him at night, you see, and he tells him that there is not going to be a loss of life. If, of course, it's Paul.
Bear in mind that Paul was remarkably educated.
I think he knew a lot about safety.
Yeah, he knew a lot about everything. He was what you call intellectual. That's what you call him today. He was a very learned man.
Jim, something that's kind of beside the lesson here, but it's pretty interesting. For many years, they didn't know how to build ships, you know, in the right proportion.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, they built them the same dimension as Noah's Ark. And they found out that was the best way to build even modern ships. Still,
same proportion, of course,
about that the same way. They found out it was ideal.
Now, as they let forth, why did they leave Fair Havens? Do you remember? A gentle south wind began to blow. So they thought they were rid of all the tumultuous northern winds.
But they had a name for those winds.
No. Well, it's that northeastern wind that's going to blow. It was called Euroclydon.
Yeah.
I don't know where the emphasis or the accent is on that word. Euroclydon. Who has a pronunciation?
Uracula.
Yeah, the literal Greek says Uracula. So if you want to spell that either way, I give you credit for it, but you might need to remember that.
Is that with an E or a U?
E-U.
And it's not as abbreviated.
The question was brought up in one class years ago is why this word was capitalized. Proper noun.
It was a special name for a wind.
Evidently.
Yeah. It was a special name for a wind.
So did it with a proper noun?
Yeah. See, I read something about that wind. I forgot why it was called that. But anyway, it was a wind that blew from the northeast. I believe this is right as I have it here. From the northeast. And this is the reason. You see, they were going to sail over here to Phoenix. Right over here. It was a good harbor. And they were going to stay there for the winter. So when a gentle south wind began to blow, this would help them stay up near the island, you see. And it would, of course, be conducive. They could sail very well under these circumstances. The sea would be calm. And they were just going to sail right along here. But when they got, maybe within a few hours of their destination here at Phoenix, or Phoenix, as the King James has it, this northeastern wind began to blow. And they could see it. What was it doing? It's blowing them farther and farther away. No way they could get back to the island. This is when they began to gird the ship up. They put these strong steel bands around underneath the ship to hold it. They knew the strong wind, the sea was going to be very strong. And they thought that possibly it would drive them even down into Africa, you see. That's where the wind would naturally blow them. And look, how does he know to make all those curves in that? It didn't tell you that way.
It might have.
You might even put a lot more zigzags than that in, you see. But anyway, there are some important points here. Let's come and go down to the 27th chapter.
Just staring by compass.
Well, it says he fetched a compass, didn't he? But he didn't have a compass.
There's a point there about when the compass was invented. And sometimes it's kind of embarrassing about the Mormons. Way back there before Christ.
talk about Thomas. Mm. You go to any encyclopedia, and I think Thomas invented, well, something like that. And so, even though they had the idea of direction, the magnetic compass was invented, I think.
And the King James says, when they fetched a compass, which is actually describing when they set a course, is what they did. The only way they guided themselves in this period of time of Satan was by the stars. The stars and the sun. The sun by day and the stars by day. That's right. That's the reason that when this wind comes, this storm comes, see, they don't see any stars or sun for several days. So they realize all the trouble they're getting into. They began to cast some things overboard. Some of the tacking, for instance, this was the material that was used for repairs on the ship. And eventually, when they come right down here and they begin to sound, they realize that they hear the crashing of the waves on the shore. And they realize that something's happened. So they sound, they find for 20 fathoms, and they sound again as 15 fathoms. And that's when they throw the anchors out. Whoa, we got to stop, you see. We're going to rush headlong into the island, or into the land. And so they put the anchors out, and they stay there the night. In verse 19 of 27, the third day we cast out with our hands the tackling of the ship. That's what I mentioned. And when neither sun nor stars in many days appeared, and no small tempest lay on us, all hope that we should be saved was then taken away. See, they thought, well, there's no way in the world we can be saved now. We don't know where we are or where we're headed, and it doesn't seem like there's any end. We've lost all account of the place where we're going.
That's a very moving.
Yes.
That's the climax. All hope, we should be saved. Yeah.
Before that, they might have had some inkling, you know. But there's none at all.
They just gave up.
Several days without any way of finding out any location. All right, now verse 21, Paul says, now you ought to listen to me. I told you so, you know. But you didn't. But he says, now don't fear, because there shall be no small loss, or there shall be no loss of any man's life among you, but of the ship. The ship is going to be lost, but no man is going to die. Now, he goes on and says, the angel told him, fear not, thou must be brought before Caesar. Now, this, you see, has been intimated before, that God had told Paul that he was going to appear before the kings. And then finally, that Paul was to go to Rome. Paul says, now, I don't know what awaits me, but I'm ready to go. And then finally, he appeals his case to Caesar. And now, the final revelation comes. Now, you're not going to die, Paul. No one's going to die because you've got to appear before Caesar. So this is God showing the full of the revelation, the purpose of Paul's journey. So we're going to be cast on a certain island, he said. Now, here's another interesting point. In verse 27, but when the 14th night was come, as we were driven up and down in Adria, about midnight, the shipmen deemed that they drew near to some country and sounded and found it 20 fathoms. When they go a little farther, they sounded again and found it 15 fathoms. And fearing lest we should fall upon rocks, they cast four anchors out of the stern and wished for the day. And as the shipmen were about to flee out of the ship, when they had let down the boat into the sea under cover, as though they had or would have cast anchors out of the foreship. Now you see what's happening. The sailors realize that all hope is gone, and they know that land is nearby. So they've cast out four anchors already to hold the ship. Now, under pretense, you see, under color, the King James says, under pretense that they're going to put out some other anchors in the fore part of the ship, and they start to lower this boat, what do they have in mind? Not going to put out anchors at all. We're going to head for land, you see. So Paul stops them with the centurion. He tells them that except they abide in the ship, then they can't be saved. I'm sure Paul knew what he was talking about here. Because all men were to be saved, there was to be no loss of life, but the condition, of course, is that they are to stay in the ship. So they cut the boat loose and let it fall. Then Paul takes meat and gives it to them and tells them to be of good cheer, which is a pretty hard thing to do. Evidently, if they're normal men, and they were, there'd been a lot of seasickness and a lot of concern and worry about life, and they just hadn't been too interested in eating. So now he tells them to eat. How many people on the ship?
276.
That's a pretty good sized ship. Carrying all that wheat and all these passengers. Some of them, of course, workers, and others soldiers, and some, like Paul, prisoners. So they eat, and Then verse 40, when they had taken up the anchors, they committed themselves into the sea. Now they have in mind, when morning comes, they can see that along the island here, along the land, there's a little river, there's a little creek of some kind. Of course, the wind is still blowing, the sea is still just boiling, and the waves are breaking tremendously. But they see this little creek, little inlet into the island. And have in mind that we're going to loose the anchors, and we're going to head it right for that little inlet. And we're going to run to ground, you see. That would be the best place. It would be a little safety and security there. It would be close to the island. It would be the deepest place of water where they can run the ship the farthest. So they cut the anchors loose. They loosed the rudder bands. They, in times like this, when they're holding anchor, they're not trying to direct the ship. So they pull the rudders out of the water and band them down, you see, to the boat. So they wouldn't be in the water anyway. Wouldn't be in any danger of being lost. So now they cut these bands and the rudders are going to fall down. They hoist up the mainsail to the wind and made toward shore, just about as fast as you could go, really. And, of course, they have in mind that they're going to run it aground. And falling into place where two seas met, they ran the ship aground, and the forepart stuck fast and remained unmovable, but the hinder part was broken with the violence of the waves. Now, they didn't make it as far as they wanted to go. They might have landed close to it, but they ran it aground, and as they did, and the forepart of the ship was stuck in the ground, then the two seas that were meeting together, you see, was hitting the ship from both sides, and the water was just tearing the ship all apart. So the soldiers' counsel was to kill the prisoners, lest any of them should swim out and escape. Of course, that'd take care of Paul, but the centurion put a stop to that. And they all jumped off ship. Still, the water was evidently above their heads, and they swam, of course, as many as could swam, and the others on pieces of the ship or pieces of wood, and all escaped to the land safe. So the 28th chapter begins with their stay on the island of Melita or on Malta. They're two names for the same island. Now, like I said, I'm not going to ask you to memorize all the places, but I want you to remember this one because there are some significant events here. The people are barbarous. How does that describe them? Foreigners. Cannibals?
Foreigners.
Just foreigners, that's all they were. They weren't Romans. They weren't Jews.
They spoke a language that was not understood.
Mm-hmm. But the ship and the people on the ship were quite fortunate in landing here on the island of Melita, being shipwrecked here, because the people were very kind to them. The first thing to do, of course, is to build a big fire. It's going to take a pretty good fire to warm 276 men. But as I believe as McGarvey pointed out, Paul was completely unlike many preachers who don't believe in getting their hands dirty. He was instrumental in gathering sticks himself, you see, and he was putting sticks on the fire, and this is when the snake came out and attached itself to his hand. What did the people think when they saw
him? Right quick.
Yeah, they thought, well, he must be a murderer, some bad man, you see, because he's escaped the shipwreck only that the gods are going to take his life now. He's not going to get away. He must be some evil, bad man. But he shook him off in the fire and felt no harm. So they changed their mind. You see, now he's a god. Now he must be something different. And then on this island, there was a man by the name of Publius, whichever way you want to pronounce it. And he had a father who, the King James says, was sick of a fever and a bloody flux. That's a very crude expression, I guess. But it describes a very bad condition. One that was almost untreatable. It was actually a fever accompanied by dysentery. And evidently the dysentery had become very bad. It could have been a result of many things, or it could have been a result of many types of bacteria. But most people didn't recover from it. So Paul healed the man. And of course, I'm sure that Publius was very grateful for that. And many of the others on the island were brought to him, and they were healed as well. 3 months they stay in Melita. They winter here in Melita, which they should have done back over in Fair Havens. Paul said you should have done that. But then they leave in verse 13 is where the King James says, and from thence we fetched a compass. What does the other translation say? Anybody have a...
Made a circuit.
Made a circuit. What they were doing was tacking, setting their course, you see. And they came to Rhegium. And now as you journey on up here, you find that they left the island here come across by us. How do you pronounce that? I've been so used to pronouncing Cilicia.
Sicily.
I couldn't think of that Sicily. All right, here is Regium, right in here. Then they leave Regium, and sail on up into the upper part of the coast of Italy. And there are two places that the brethren meet them. And one is the Appii Forum, and the other is the Three Taverns. These are two small towns about 30 or 40 miles from Rome itself.
What verse is that in here?
That's in verse 15. Now they've heard that Paul is coming, so many of the brethren come down to meet him. Some in the Appii Forum, and the others at the Three Taverns, two small towns. And then Paul comes into Rome, verse 16. The centurion delivered the prisoners to the captain of the guard, but Paul was suffered to dwell by himself with a soldier that kept him. He was chained to a soldier all the time that he was there. Then 3 days after this, Paul calls for the chief of the Jews. Why do you think he called for the chief of the Jews? I think there are two reasons. Number one is that very likely these Jews have already heard about the accusation made against Paul back in Jerusalem, you see. But when Paul begins to state what had happened, and the fact that he wasn't coming here, some might have thought he might have come to accuse the Jews. Paul says, that's not the reason I've come here. The reason I'm here is because the Jews made accusation against me, and I've come to defend myself. That's the reason. But then, he gets an opportunity to preach to them, and he does preach to them. And some of them believe, and some of them do not. And you don't have to remember. Let's see, I don't remember whether I asked you anything. I've already made out questions from this section for the test, so I might better remember what I've asked you. Let me look over this for just a moment. You might remember the quotation from Isaiah 6, I believe it is. For the heart of this people is waxed gross. This is the way Paul finishes his sermon after he preaches to them, and some of them believe and some of them don't. Evidently there's something that's said, and so he finishes his lesson in a very stern way. Quotation, I believe, is from Isaiah 6. The heart of this people is waxed gross, and their ears are dull of hearing, and their eyes have they closed, lest they should see with their ears and see with their eyes and hear with their ears and understand with their heart, and should be converted, and I should heal them. Of course, that's what God says in the Old Testament about his people. But now the application of it is to the Jews who will not hear what Paul says. In verse 30 and 31, and Paul dwelt 2 whole years in his own hired house and received all that came in unto him. What was he doing here? Preaching the kingdom of God and teaching those things which concern the Lord Jesus Christ with all confidence, no man forbidding him. So his stay here now for 2 years is in his own hired house. The soldier is accompanying the whole time, but now all the time that he's here, no man's forbidden to come into him. Anybody that wants to come and listen can hear, and Paul is busy the whole time preaching the kingdom of God and teaching those things which concern the Lord Jesus Christ.